I've interviewed many successful people over the years, and one thing I find fascinating is many of them don't consider themselves business savvy. Take the owners of Tight Knit Brewing. They turn to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards, and do all of it in one place with the Chase mobile app. And that's helped these brew-loving friends turn a passion into a business. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by actor Kyle MacLachlan. 40 years ago this week, MacLachlan made his on-screen debut in Dune. It was an adaptation of the beloved 1965 sci-fi novel written by Frank Herbert and brought to the screen by director David Lynch. The film was a box office bomb, but has since become something of a cult classic. It also, more importantly, marked the beginning of a fruitful collaboration between Lynch and MacLachlan, including Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks, both of which we discuss at length in this episode. In recent years, MacLachlan has continued to make inspired and surprising choices, leaning into comedy in shows like Sex and the City and Portlandia, or criminally underseen films like Steven Soderbergh's High Flying Bird and Greg Mottola's Confessed Fletch. His willingness to experiment and to remain curious is one of his great gifts, I think. It's a gift that's also on full display in his latest project, Varnamtown. It's not a film, although it probably will be one day, but instead a podcast hosted by MacLachlan and journalist Joshua Davis. I could explain the show, but why don't we let them take it over for a second? Here's a little bit from the trailer of the new show, Varnamtown.
Okay, Kyle, tell me what you know about the connection between REO Speedwagon, the super band from the 70s and 80s, and Pablo Escobar, the drug kingpin.
Well, sometime in the early 80s, REO Speedwagon's airplane made an unannounced middle-of-the-night landing.
This is my friend Kyle MacLachlan, the star of Twin Peaks. And he's telling me about how he discovered a real-life Twin Peaks in rural North Carolina, not far from where he filmed Blue Velvet.
What was on the plane was copious amounts of drugs coming in from South America. Supposedly, Pablo Escobar went looking for other spots, quiet, out-of-the-way places to bring in his cocaine.
Okay, hold on. You're saying that a town of 300 people, en masse, did a deal with Pablo Escobar?
Yes, that's what I heard.
In promoting this new show of his, he's become something of a sudden internet sensation, taking to Instagram and TikTok, where his team of what I assume are very, very young people have immersed him in the worlds of Lorde and Lana Del Rey, taking part in trends that I definitely don't understand, but that my sister insists are very cool. And so we do discuss this new viral fame towards the end of this conversation. But to start, we talk about this new podcast of his and the small town in North Carolina where Pablo Escobar brokered a deal. I think ultimately this show is born out of Kyle's love of small towns, especially coming of age in Yakima, Washington, which of course would then later be repurposed in the hit show Twin Peaks. And so with that, I hope you enjoy this very fun, sometimes silly, sometimes serious conversation with actor and now podcaster, Kyle MacLachlan. This is kind of a loaded question to ask you, but how's your coffee?
This coffee?
Yeah.
It's quite good, actually.
Is it?
Yeah. But my taste level in terms of coffee varies with the situation.
Yeah. It's kind of a daunting question to ask Kyle MacLachlan.
I am sort of known for my coffee prowess,
yes.
I guess. Yeah.
I think everyone on the team was nervous about satisfying your high standards.
My high standards. Not that high, in fact, I got to say. You know, when you work on a set, you kind of, whatever coffee's there is what you go with. Keurig was a big one when we were doing the Twin Peaks Return. I can't remember what we did in the original, what it was. But I can even work with diner coffee in New York.
When you're out at a place, do people often ask you, how is it?
They want to hear me say, this is damn fine coffee.
Now we can start the show.
Yeah, good.
Kyle MacLachlan.
Sam.
Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm really good. Thank you for asking. I'm very happy to be here.
It is a joy to have you here. And for the last couple years, you yourself have been making this new podcast of yours.
Yes.
And it's now out. It's called Varmintown. I thought we'd just start here because...
Okay, great.
You'd heard the story that would become this show a few years back.
Right.
And it's my understanding that you, upon hearing the story, called up your future co-host, Joshua Davis, who's an excellent investigative reporter in his own right.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, on that phone call to him, how did you explain the story that would become Varnumtown?
I gave him the highlights. And Josh is, as you said, he's an incredible investigative reporter, and he has a terrific sense of story. And he heard 80s Pablo Escobar town in coastal North Carolina, small town. You couldn't even call it a town of 300 people, a community, really. Mm. And I said, what do you think? And he said, I think there's something here. I think this is an interesting story. And I asked, I said, you know, I recognize that. I said, but I don't do what you do. You're an investigative journalist. You go and you know how to ask the questions. You know, you're almost like a prosecuting attorney. You know what I mean? He goes in with a very clear idea of kind of where he's trying to go. And I'm kind of like, hey, so tell me about, you know, did you ever do any cocaine when you were in Varnumtown? I would ask the wrong questions.
That's your lead question. For our listeners who maybe haven't heard the show yet.
Yeah.
How would you explain this podcast?
Josh Davis, we're speaking about it, myself. We decided to create a story within a story. So Varnumtown, small community, coastal North Carolina.
This is back in the 80s.
Back in the 80s became one of the top smuggling ports for drugs coming out of South America, specifically drugs coming from the cartel of Pablo Escobar. So Josh and I went down and we decided what we're going to do is do a little interview session with the people that were involved. So we took 6 days to speak to the people that were there. And we got their stories and we put them together. And then we put together a journey based upon those interviews. So it's Josh and I trying to figure out what really happened based on the interviews that we did.
So back in the 80s, there was this town of about 300 people, like you said. Mm. At that point, Escobar and the cartel had been smuggling drugs into ports in Miami.
Correct.
But soon realized that they were just too heavily trafficked. There were too many cops.
Yeah.
And they wanted to find a kind of sleepy Twin Peaks-like town.
Yes.
where they could go sort of more undercover.
Yeah, it was the perfect setting because there's no one around. Varnamtown is very isolated. It sits on a series of waterways
right.
in coastal North Carolina. When you think of a backwater town, this is what it is.
Really. And the community thought what of this newfound business venture?
Well, the central figure in this is a guy named Dale Varnum, and he made the deal and began this process of illegally importing these substances, which grew quickly.
There are multiple substances?
Multiple substances. You have marijuana, primarily marijuana, cocaine, quaaludes were also a big deal back then, and those were being smuggled into.
Rest in peace. I don't think that they exist anymore.
They don't. I don't know what happened.
Did you ever try those?
No.
Really?
I'm not much of a, you know.
I feel like 80s back then, you never.
I know.
When the opportunity was right.
I know. I didn't really. I was
born in 94, so it's, I think they were gone by then.
You're completely innocent. Innocent by birth.
So tell me this. The main figure is this man named Dale.
Dale Varnum. This is what we had gleaned from our conversations with the person down there who had first broken the story to me. The Dale was kind of the kingpin. As we got through the journey of interviewing everyone, we realized that the story was much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
And Dale, while he was an important part of it, was maybe not the central figure that we had thought he was. So soon you had small freighters coming up the coast loaded with contraband that would be offloaded into the port of Varnamtown and then trucked from there across country.
And did a new sort of more affluent community rise up because of this?
Not really. It was so out of the way. The people weren't aware. The people of the community were making lots of money mm-hmm. very quickly.
And they were okay with how they made that money.
There are certainly people that did not agree with what was happening. And we spoke with them during the interviews, which was an interesting perspective. We spoke with everyone from law enforcement to the smugglers to the people who were opposed. So we covered a pretty good range. But there were definitely people who were opposed to what was happening, did not agree with what was happening. But you got to imagine this depressed community. Shrimping was the main industry. That was on hard times. There was no money coming in, no way to make a buck, you know. And here was this huge opportunity. And people said, hey, I can support my family. I can, you know, I can make my life a little easier, you know, by doing this. And, you know, was it no harm, no foul is what they were thinking.
So when you and Josh head to North Carolina to make this podcast,
you're
knocking door to door, and I'm curious about like your approach to that. Like, would you go to the door and say like, "Hi, I'm Kyle McLaughlin. You may recognize me as Agent Cooper from
such
Twin
roles
Peaks.
As mm-hmm.
that was also a show set in a small town, much like yours."
Yes.
What was your pitch in this like journalistic pursuit?
We were, thankfully, we didn't have to go door to door necessarily. The woman, again, who her name is Lynn Betts, who's written a book, in fact, about this. She was in contact with most of the people and had remained in contact because of the book that she'd written about this with most of the people that we were interested in speaking with. So she was very helpful in setting up the interviews and sort of clearing the way for us. And we sat with the different people, you know, over the course of these five or six days, doing, you know, many hours of interviews, which Josh, I will say, led most of them. I chimed in now and then with the, you know, the odd question. But I got to say, most of the people that we spoke with were very willing to speak. It wasn't like we were trying to grill them or get something out of them that they didn't want to share.
Right.
So they were all there to talk about this. And was really, the questions were really more about the specifics of what we needed to know to move the story forward.
Now that you've done it and now that the show's coming out,
yeah,
what do you make of the story, big picture? How have you come to understand it more intimately?
I think there was a real sense of that there was something that was positive about it in that, and particularly the character of the role of Dale Varnum. I think he felt like he was really doing the community a service and helping.
Do you believe that?
Yeah, I think that was part of his, I think there was a genuine need to wanting to help the community. Yeah, it's also, you got to remember, this was a depressed community in the 80s. Not much excitement, if you can imagine, going on. So the idea that there was this big smuggling operation coming through, people were involved, lots of money was being dished out. I mean, that's kind of, and this is during the days of Miami Vice, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, they were like, hey, you know,
You ever audition for that?
We're like Miami Vice. I never did. I would have liked to audition for that. Because it was, remember, always the supporting role was always like a real juicy. In fact, it was one of the first shows on television where actors coming from film would do a guest star.
Yeah, because
it
Columbo.
Was. Yeah, and Columbo.
Yeah.
Peter Falk.
Some of the finest.
I know. When were you born, you said?
Somewhere between 1944 and 1994.
I was going to say, if you know Columbo, I'm impressed. You're going back.
Well, we're going to go back a little bit further.
Oh,
because
boy. Okay.
You were born in Yakima, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe part of the reason this small town in North Carolina and its residents entrusted you with this story is because you yourself came of age in a small town.
I did.
That was also the reason when you met David Lynch for the first time auditioning for Dune, that he kind of saw something in you. He felt a kinship with you, and in part because of
yeah.
that small town.
He did.
But I want to go back to a little before you auditioned for Dune. Which
I thought you were going to say before I was born.
I have your whole family chart right here.
Oh, dear. Now I'm nervous.
Before you work on Dune and David Lynch and make your debut,
yeah.
I want to stick with North Carolina for a second because I think it's there, after your freshman year of college in the summer of 1978 at the Flat Rock Playhouse
mm-hmm.
in a production called Look Homeward, Angel, that your ideas around acting seem to be kind of transformed. Is that right?
It's very good research on your part. And you are 100% correct. My journey into acting was not one where I really knew what I wanted. I knew that I was good at it, but I didn't really know how do you right. go about it.
You had done a little bit in high school.
Yeah, high school, I'd done that. My mom had helped sort of propel me into that. I think she saw that there was a talent in there. I loved doing the high school musicals and plays. But the next step was college, and I was really lost my first year of college and ended up going back home, dropping out my last semester of my first year and working to make some money. And the idea was I was going to go to this summer stock, really, mm-hmm. theater company. And while I was there as an apprentice, I was cast as the lead role in Look Homeward, Angel, which was the chestnut that they did every year at Flat Rock Playhouse. Thomas Wolfe was the original author. He was born in Asheville, and audiences loved it. So I was cast. I had my first real professional acting experience. I had a wonderful director named Earl Wentz, who pretty much talked me through the whole thing. And that was the summer of 78. And I went back again in the summer of 79, did the role again. Had a very meaningful relationship, one of my first early relationships with an actress. And it was a magical summer and really set me on my path.
Mm.
And I returned to school with a new direction and with a new desire to train as an actor.
A new sense of purpose.
It was.
You said once, it was like the whole world blew apart. It felt so comfortable. It was like I was gradually learning that it was okay to be imperfect.
That's a pretty big statement.
It is a big statement. Sounds like the
statement dramatic.
From the eldest son
yes.
of a family that looked to that son to be close to perfect.
It was a family where there were expectations, mm-hmm. that's for sure. But it was also a family that had a tremendous allowance. When you think about it, my dad was a stockbroker. My mom was, she studied as a school teacher, and then she was in public relations. Then she got back into the education world for the school system. So this is what they know. They have three sons. All three of them pursued careers in the arts for at mm-hmm. least a period of time. So I went into the acting thing pretty early on. My middle brother, Craig, was a musician for a number of years. My youngest brother was also an actor. And then they moved on to other things. But our parents were allowing that to happen, which was pretty special.
When you go back to college and you finish up your time over there, what about acting made sense to you? What about it excited you enough to say, all right, I think I need to do this?
You know, I was inspired by some of what I saw at school, and nothing more than the reaction of like, I want to do that.
So it was a visceral reaction.
Very visceral. There was a training program at the University of Washington at the time, professional actors training program, that was very intense, very specialized training, acting training. In fact, I got a BFA in acting. And these were actors that were trained for repertory theater. So all day was spent doing some aspect of what you might do as an actor, not as a set designer or as a lighting person, but this is only acting. I was a horrible student.
In what sense?
I couldn't do any of the exercises right. It took a while to sort of tame me and bring me in and to understand why these things were important. It was a lot to do with emotions, uh-huh. And those were things that I was not comfortable with.
And why was that?
I think it was just maybe expectations, you said earlier, you know, as you know, perfect, the kind of things like that, or that these were not things you necessarily were going to show. I was much more comfortable with funny comedy, you know, fun stuff.
Right.
Some of the more dark and difficult and emotional experiences or scenes, if you will, or those, even those just emotions, I was not really comfortable with.
So then you take your aversion to dark and difficult emotions,
yes,
and decide, you know what I should do is work with David Lynch.
Yeah.
On my first film. You're a little bit out of college. You're 23, yeah. 24 years old. Mm. You fly to Los Angeles for an audition.
Yeah.
And what would become this $40 million film in Dune.
Yeah.
But I want to hold that day that you auditioned for a second.
Yeah.
You touch down in LAX in the afternoon. You're taken to the Universal lot and you're told to wait as David Lynch finishes his late lunch of coffee and chocolate milkshakes at Bob's Big Boy across the street.
Mm.
It's where he went to lunch almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
Always a late lunch. Always opting for the coffee and chocolate milkshakes.
Yeah.
I would have had a heart attack by day three of that experience. As you're sitting there waiting,
right,
I was wondering what images in this moment first come to mind. Like, what do you remember seeing and what do you remember feeling in that moment?
The backlot bungalows is where I had been taken. I didn't know that that's what they were, but this is where they were prepping for Dune. They were small, had a certain kind of smell because they'd been around for a long time.
What kind of smell?
You know, it was kind of a musty, old smell. You know, you walk into a place. I mean, the carpet was new and everything, but it was an old construction.
Because this is an audio medium, so you need to add description.
Very good. It was a dark and stormy night.
There we go. Now we know you're a podcaster.
And I sat and I thought to myself, David's coming. And everyone was like, David's coming. I was like, I wonder what he's like. You know, I have no idea.
I'd
seen Eraserhead and I thought, this is an unusual film. I said, I have no idea.
Really? I saw it and I thought, that's a well-adjusted man.
This is someone you want to spend some time with in a dark room. And I remember seeing, they said, oh, he's here. He comes in and is sort of a, hey, how you doing? Very friendly, kind of feels like a Midwestern kind of sensibility. Great to see you. Yeah, he has kind of a little bit of a twang, kind of a nasal thing like this. And sit down and really made me feel comfortable and very personable. And we sat in a room and I remember it was kind of a desk chair, not much going on as you would imagine in those, because they're temporary, these facilities. And we just sat and we talked, not about Dune. We talked about where you grew up, you know, and what it was like. And turns out we shared the Pacific Northwest as a location for, he's from Missoula, grew up in Missoula and some of the other cities around that area. His dad was in the Forest Service. I grew up in Yakima. We, you know, sort of talked about that. So I talked about spending time up at Priest Lake when I was a little kid with my grandparents and he recognized that. He said, oh yeah, I knew about that. So we found these common links. And at the end of the conversation, he said, here's the script to Dune. And he handed me a very thick script, my first ever film script that I'd seen. It's like, wow. And he said, you learn these scenes here, and they had been marked up, and we'll screen test and, you know, come back in about 4 or 5 days and we'll screen test. And I said, sounds great. So I went back to Seattle and I learned the scenes, came back down 5 days later and screen tested, very nervous.
How did you work through those nerves?
I think I was ready. You know, I'd graduated, spent 3 years in training, very intense training. I kind of launched into the world. I worked at the Shakespeare Festival right out of school. I was doing a play in Seattle. I'd had some success and I was on my way. And I think there was a sense of confidence that was there that overrode the nerves. And I couldn't believe how nice all the people were that I was surrounded by. You know, they had hair and makeup. I never had hair and makeup done. This is something you did in the theater yourself. They had the costume for you, the wardrobe stuff. And I was like, this is amazing. And I remember we were working at John Dykstra's studio, Apogee Studio, which is where they had the screen test, and had the scenes down cold. And I knew kind of what to do. And he just told me to do, you know, stand here, do this, kind of like laid it out for me. I'd never been in front of a camera before. I had to do one speech in particular straight to the camera. That was the tough one. That's where I sort of lost my focus. And David came in and said, you got this. He just said, you know, you're going to be okay. Just, you know, take your time. It's all right. You're doing great. You know, just a very simple words of encouragement that I took to heart and finished the scene. And I went back to my hotel, the Beverly Garland Holiday Inn, and there was a bottle of wine on my table. And David had sent that bottle over as a gesture of goodwill, thank you, and kind of, I think I hope this works out.
Your description of the beginning of your career sounds very serene.
Yeah.
Sort of easygoing. The making of the movie, was it as easygoing as that?
Well, it was an adventure.
Yes.
It was an adventure.
You're down in Mexico.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is like when you're on the set of your first movie and it's this big enterprise and you're the lead of it and Sting is in it.
Yep.
Interesting choice.
Yes.
Now that the film is like celebrating its 40th anniversary this year.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, did you know when you were making it that things were not going perhaps as planned?
I didn't have anything to compare it to.
Right. Did it seem normal?
It seemed normal to me in a weird way. It seemed extravagant and it was spectacular to look at. The sets that we were working in were complete rooms.
Right.
It wasn't like a fake, you know, breakaway stuff.
Tons of extras.
Tons of extras. Costumes were insanely meticulous and beautiful, and some of them were rather uncomfortable. But I just, and I loved the people I was working with. I got, you know, Patrick Stewart, Everett McGill, Jürgen Prochnow, Max von Sydow, Francesca Annis. I mean, Sean Young, on and on. People were, it was like we were having a great, great time
right.
making this. I was having a great time making this.
So come 1984, when the film comes out, you're in Washington, D.C. for the premiere.
Right.
You bring your two brothers, your stepsister, and your two parents, both of whom had remarried. I think, at that point.
Yeah.
They also brought their new spouses.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what I'm trying to understand. I'm trying to imagine. You're sitting in the theater. This film comes on.
Right.
Are you watching your mother's reaction the whole time, part of the time?
I was certainly aware of it. But it was me seeing the film, too, for the first time. So
tell me, what was your family's reaction to the movie? And then how do you remember that night and the crowd's reaction to the film?
It was surreal is a good word to use, I think, because it did feel and I was definitely out of body. In addition to my family, I'd also invited a couple of my good friends as well who were there. So I had a huge entourage. Everyone within my group seemed to really enjoy it, had a good time. I don't know how much they understood. I think they were just kind of overwhelmed, honestly. So the experience that night was wonderful and people had a great time. Everything was...
And your mom liked it?
It was good. My mom liked it. I think she was just so proud. My mom was one of those very proud moms. Uh-huh. And that she had encouraged me initially to get into the theater and initially to help her out because she was sort of managing this teen theater company, the musical side of this teenage theater group. And she needed people to come. And so we were drafted. My brothers and I were drafted. But I really enjoyed it. I didn't think I was going to enjoy it. I resisted. But then I said, no, this is actually really fun and socially a good time, you know? So she set it in motion.
So the seed she planted kind of came to life in that moment.
And suddenly she sees this, what's happening. And I think it was overwhelming for her. And I think she was just so proud.
When the film opened, you said once that David and I went into a sort of tailspin. In 1985, what did that look like?
Well, so Dune premiered in December of 84. And I remember we had the premiere and everything was great. I all went back home. We had Christmas at home in Yakima. And shortly after Christmas, the intention was that we were going to go shoot Blue Velvet because David had given me the script of Blue Velvet. We were going to start on that in January. Well, I got a call that said the film's been put on hold. Dune, no one really said that Dune wasn't doing very well. It wasn't doing very well, but I wasn't really paying attention. I was focused on the next thing. I just remember getting the call for some reason at my dad's office. I don't know why they called me there. Huh. But I had a manager at that time. They called and said, I think you better come down and, you know, we got to sort of get going here on the next thing because there was nothing.
How did you feel on that?
I was like, okay. I said, sounds like another adventure. I was really up for it. And I said, well, so I packed up my stuff. I got in my Jeep and I drove to Los Angeles and found an apartment. I had an agent already and I had a manager who was working, had a lawyer. And so I was like, all right, we'll figure this out.
Team.
I had a whole team in place. Yeah.
But when you say tailspin, what did that look like?
Well, I think it was because we were going to go shoot Blue Velvet and then that got canceled. And then so David suffered as well. So he had, you know, everything all lined up to go. And then suddenly it's not going. So it's like, we got to figure this out because Dune got severely damaged by the critics. It was not pretty. And so it was really about finding the new direction. And we didn't start Blue Velvet until, I think, August of that year.
Right.
I think that's what was it.
So my understanding is based on all the interviews you did at that time, and you did a lot, you've described the time as a dark, dark period. The way you're talking about it now doesn't sound that dark, but at the time, that's how you described it. To hear you basically start your career and rapidly ascend and then do quickly descend.
Yeah.
What did that feel like? What did that look like? Exactly?
I think I just, because I know what you're saying, and so I'm kind of surprised at my response as well. I think part of it was just naivete. As I look back on it, I knew that I was not aware of the significance of that kind of response from the industry is something very difficult to come back from, because you were given this golden opportunity and it failed tremendously, and all the hopes and the expectations that you might have, or even from people that are thinking, hey, there's a, you know, that's why I had 5 Dune options and 3 non-Dune options, as Dino says, I'm going to make this kid a star, and we're going to use that, you know what I mean? And we're going to put him in doing all these things. That didn't happen. Thankfully, actually, at the end of the day, I was lucky.
Why do you say that?
Well, it was just, you know, everything had been negotiated, pre-negotiated. Not that it couldn't have been changed, but I didn't have that much choice in what I was going to end up having to do, whatever that was going to be. I was looking forward to doing more Dunes. I mean, I loved the book growing up. This was had a huge influence on my life when I was a kid. But Blue Velvet, when I read the script that David gave me while we were filming Dune, I was really enchanted with it. I really, there was something about it that I felt connected to somehow, or I understood the journey. It was interesting. It was something I could really, you know, playing Paul Atreides is a challenge because so much of it is internal. And here was Jeffrey Beaumont going through these experiences. And I said, oh, this is kind of something that I can relate to, understand what might happen with the character.
Someone having some trouble accessing emotions.
Yeah, but at the same time, that was part of the journey for me, because he does get to the point where
a breaking point.
And that was it was a breaking point for the character. It was also sort of a breakthrough point for me in an odd way, because it required this emotional reaction, this response. And David, again, coming back to David, was very, very generous and helpful, gentle through the process, and allowed me the time and space to be able to do that scene. You know, it helped me sort of get through that.
What were you working block. Through at that time?
I think it was just the idea of that kind of exposure.
Exposure
like,
to?
That kind of like vulnerability, honestly. I think in that moment, in an environment that is not necessarily, you're surrounded by people, the camera's there, there's a clock ticking, there's an expectation this is going to happen at a certain point in time in the scene. And that stuff will make, you know, it makes you freeze up. Makes me freeze up. Makes me tighten up is a good word. But again, David was, you know, generous and kind with the time and the allowance and everything. And I was like, okay.
I've rewatched the film recently, and what's striking to me, and in part because of the research, is that while you're making this film, it seems to me that you were grappling with this divorce that your parents had had not that long before.
Right.
And your mother, who was very sick at the time.
Yeah.
I think she had ovarian cancer. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah.
That seems like a whole lot to hold on top of the charged, unsettling world of Blue Velvet.
Yeah. There was a lot going on. I mean, in terms of the divorce that happened
your senior year of high school.
Yeah, 77. And it was
we all deal with things usually on a
delay. In a different way. Yeah. No, it's true. And especially if you're young and somewhat self-absorbed, as I was.
I don't have that in my notes.
Young and self-absorbed.
I didn't find that in the research.
But at the same time, I think my brothers and I recognized that our mom wasn't working with my dad, and she had found someone that she felt very connected to, and we were happy for her. Mm. At the same time, we know it was difficult for my father, of course, and we sort of would try to be there for him as well.
Well, there's so much more than what meets the eye in both Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks, and then your new podcast, obviously. There's this tension and turmoil bubbling underneath the surface, with you at the center playing characters that have been described as, quote, Dudley Do-Rights with dark closets in their souls, decent guys with timeshares in the netherworld.
I like that, yeah.
And I was wondering, I don't know, like, especially in the aftermath of your mother's passing, because she never got to see this film, did she?
She never saw Blue Velvet.
She never got to see Blue Velvet.
Which is probably a blessing. Although I give her credit. I think she would have come away understanding what David was trying to do. It's a difficult journey.
It's a difficult journey and a difficult film, even now talking about it.
Yeah.
But do you think you were especially attuned to these projects, to playing characters with friendly exteriors, complicated interiors? Mm. Because you yourself moved through the world as that eager to please model child.
Right.
The person that you said was not comfortable with emotions at Summerstock.
Yeah. See, the thing is, I don't feel that I was that different than most of the people that were around me. My peers, I guess. You know, certainly in school, you know, these are things that you wrestled with. And I just chose to not deal with them when I was in school, and chose other, you know, I would do a left turn on something. I was like, oh, that's not, I'm not going to go in. I'm not going to go there. You know what I mean?
Did you consciously do that?
Yeah. I remember one in particular. There was, we were meant to do, an emotional scene in our voice class, where we wrote our own thing, a story of some kind, a personal story.
Yeah.
And I certainly had a lot that I could have talked with, but I was always worried or concerned or afraid that it would either explode or I don't know. I was just afraid of what might come out. Let's just say that, you know, and I said, I don't want to see that or show that or have people see that. I was like, no, I don't think so. So I would always do a comedy thing and, you know, sort of dance out of it that way.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher was always like shaking her head, like, you did not do the exercise. And I don't know if I can pass you in this course. But I finally did. I finally did one day.
And you do kind of explode towards the end of Blue Velvet.
Yeah. He has such a journey, that character. And he has the forces that are working on him, both Dennis Hopper character, Frank, and Isabella Rossellini's Dorothy, that it was more about me reacting to what they were doing than anything else.
After the break, we talk about Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, The Return, and a whole lot more. That's all coming up next with Kyle MacLachlan.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, Each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC, copyright 2024. JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
In terms of getting back to that love you felt in North Carolina in summer stock, acting for the first time in a real professional setting, going, I need to do this, that visceral feeling.
Yeah.
Was Blue Velvet or Twin Peaks the kind of first time you got to feel that on a film set?
No, you know, I felt it on everything. I think what I love, still love, is it's almost an investigative process with a character. And that kind of exploration, discovery of what this person is and how they fit within the world that they are of the story. That is always something that I loved, even though I didn't really understand what it was in the very beginning. It was that process of becoming another person, of creating another reality that I really, really liked.
So what was that process like for Agent Cooper, late 80s, early 90s, making Twin Peaks? What does that look like?
It is a lot of joy, a lot of fun, just great pleasure in exploring some of the things that he relishes as a character, whether it's fir trees or coffee or cherry pie, and kind of embracing the quirkiness of that as well.
What do you mean by that?
Well, just his turn of phrase or an observation or, you know, something he gets excited about, finding the letter under the fingernail, you know, with the tweezers, the kind of stuff like that. Having a mystery, having a secret, and then also working with David. It was simply that, the pleasure of that and the joy of seeing him smile or laugh, that felt to me like, oh, we're onto something here.
When you mentioned those like investigative elements that you were talking about and making the character, is that process different for each role? And for that one in particular, what did that look like to you?
It is different, but the journey is different, but the process is the same. So it's really about using the script as a blueprint and then bringing in your own who I am. And my thoughts and feelings about it. And then you have another layer, which is the working component with the other person and what that dynamic is and how that changes and morphs as you go through a scene.
And did your relationship with David change by that point? I know he only did the first couple episodes, but having made Dune, then Blue Velvet, and here, you two both probably changed as artists in that time.
I think, yes. I think the impact of the structure of episodic television like that on network television was one that I think we both didn't anticipate having such a strong influence. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, I think it was creatively not that fulfilling, honestly. The expectations that were that are in place that that exist for a reason. You know, you got to move the story forward. You have to satisfy your audience. And I don't think that's something that David thinks about. He's creating something that works for him when he does his work. And so I think having to answer to other people is something that he just was not into at all. That was challenging.
Yeah, you've said multiple times that you were frustrated that he made the show and that he left, and then you were kind of there to continue making it.
Trying to hold it together. But from this perspective, I understand this is not who he is as an artist. And Twin Peaks, I don't know if in their minds it really was meant to be more than what it was. I mean, I think the idea of an ongoing story was really appealing to David, but it was a story that would have had so many branches and variety, and it wasn't really about solving the murder ever, really. It was about that, about the journey of these interesting, quirky, eccentric characters.
You said at some point the show wasn't creatively satisfying to him. Did you also come to a point where it wasn't what you wanted creatively as an artist, as an actor?
I felt like that the role of Cooper over the course of time became less and less, it sort of got watered down a little bit. Part of that, my own mistakes.
Like,
and
what?
Well, when we meet him, you know, he's so identifiable in the black suit and everything. And then there was a movement to try to get him to become more localized, so they had different outfits for him. He would become more part of the community. And it was an interesting idea. I think in hindsight, I think it was a mistake. I think having him in the black suit as a, you know, as the outsider would have been a stronger choice, different, I think. But he was less and less engaged and became more and more about talking about what was happening as opposed to being involved in the actual process, I felt.
When the show does end, we've read a few quotes you've had, and there's really one that has stuck with me that I just want to hold, because you said, you know, in talking about the conditions of making work, I don't do well with manic energy around me. And I used to think that you had to have that to be a good actor. Well, when did you learn that before, during, or after you made Showgirls?
Oh, I don't remember saying the manic energy part. But I do like a focused and kind of a set that is, there's a sense of calm about it. Everyone is working in a different way. There's a sense of fun that you should enjoy being there, what you're doing, regardless of how, I mean, sometimes the scenes are not going to be that enjoyable, but you should be able to, it should be an enjoyable experience, I think. Mm-hmm. It should breathe. It's got to breathe.
But was there a period in your life where you felt like, the way to be a good actor is to have a lot of drama around me?
There is something to be said for the creating the environment. The tone of the environment that you're shooting should match the tone of what's happening in the script. You know what I mean? For the story. That's helpful.
And was that true on Showgirls?
Most of my stuff in Showgirls were two-person scenes. There was some stuff that were, or there were two person focused. It was me and Elizabeth a lot of the time. Yeah. Sometimes Gina.
I haven't seen the film in a long time. I just rewatched it.
I haven't seen it in a long time myself.
I don't know if I'll ever look at pools the same way again.
I know. Thank God they heated it. Because, you know, you spend a lot of time in the water. After 4 or 5 hours, I don't care how warm the pool is, your body is cold and you're starting, your energy is going. That part, which I don't know how the camera guys did. I mean, they're in it for the whole time.
Was the experience of that film's release similar to the Dune release?
It was another huge disaster. They screened the film for me the day before we were meant to do the press work on it, and I got sick for the press work. sadly, I came down with something very, very, yeah, it was like bad cough.
Yeah,
pre-COVID actually. But the film was, it was pretty much, I think we swept the Razzies that year. I'm sure if we didn't, we should have. There's so much camp in it, to use that word. And the only way you can really successfully do that is if you're absolutely serious in what you're creating in the moment.
Which you definitely seem to be.
Which I was. We were all very committed. So when you see it and it's completely kind of over the top, no one's winking, you know what I mean? We're all like, yes, and we're going all the way. And that's what creates this sort of successful campy movie that's, you know.
Did you close your eyes during your own sex scene?
I was working really hard to try to keep Elizabeth from falling off my lap, to be quite honest. So it was exhausting. And I felt bad for her because she was almost drowning in that sequence. It was not pretty.
I think that film, whatever the criticisms are, I think your commitment in that film and then really in everything else that was to come is maybe your greatest gift as an actor. You are committed.
Yes.
Whether it's Sex and the City.
Right.
Or Portlandia or the return of Twin Peaks, you are committed.
Yeah.
Through the 2000s, you're making all this work. You've likened your acting process to, quote, a pot of simmering water on the stove. When you wake up in the morning, when you wake up in the morning and you have to shoot that day, how do you work yourself into an emotional state?
Depends on what I need to do for the day.
Right.
But if it's a scene that is, it's going to require some release, that kind of thing, I think there's a... you know, the pot simmering metaphor is sort of, you know, you want to keep the, at least I do, I want to keep what's happening in me, whatever the, if there are memories that I have, or if it's a sense of openness that I resisted so much when I was younger, you're really working on trying to keep the channels open and available.
When did that change for you?
Oh, I think as I matured, I think, and started working more, I realized that that's how to do it. That's how what worked for me
to excavate memories.
You know, all of the actors' tools. You know, whether it's sense memory things you talk about, it gets to the point where imagination plays a big part of it. Music helps. Even you know, at a certain point in time, just the reality of the scene or the moment of the scene or what's coming off the other actor can also have that kind of impact if you're open to it and allow it.
Do you believe when actors say that acting can be therapeutic? Do you think that's true? Or do you think therapy can be therapeutic?
Yeah, can be therapeutic. You know, you're pulling from yourself a lot of what you do. The character is written, but you're trying to find places where the connection is. And if I don't have those kind of connections, then I'll look in myself or I'll try to figure out what is happening with the character. Maybe have empathy with something that would be, you've got to find a way to connect with the character. I don't know if it's therapy so much as sort of acknowledgement of something or like, oh, I never, you know, I didn't know that was in me. You know what I mean? Or I didn't know I could do that.
You know, when we began talking today, we went through this small town that's at the heart of your show, which many people have described as a real life Twin Peaks in North Carolina. And I was thinking about from 1994 till about 2015, reporters and fans would always ask you, when are you and David Lynch going to work together again? And something you'd say about the role of Agent Cooper is that, quote, with that character, a really dark ink was used. I think it needs to fade out a little more until we can come back together.
Well, I sound very poetic. It's fun because some of the quotes are like, I don't remember saying that at all. But then you sort of say, well, the writer did a nice job, right? He made me sound sort of like a
writer inside your own head.
Semi-smart. I don't know.
By the time you and Lynch made Twin Peaks The Return,
right,
did you think that dark ink had sufficiently faded? Like, what needed to happen for the two of you to come back together again?
I mean, I think it was pretty simple. I think it was the fans, honestly, that kept reminding us that in the original you had said, see you in 25 years. And so they were like, well, you know, come on, make it happen, make it so. There was that. There was also, I think, Mark Frost and David Lynch were at a place where working together was a possibility. They both, all the projects and things that they've been doing is sort of came to bear on this. But I think more than anything, it was the idea. David talks about having the idea and he needs to have an idea that then grows. I don't think he had one that was working until something, a seed was planted and it started to grow and it kept growing. I know he always loved Twin Peaks. He loves the world of Twin Peaks. And I think, but the only way he would want it to go back is if he could do it in his own way. Mm. I was nervous. I mean, I knew that Cooper would emerge. And I said, Cooper's going to be whoever he is, who's me after 25 years. Yeah. So that's going to be, that'll be what it's going to be.
Who were you 25 years later?
You know, he still has the enthusiasm. There's a sense of boyishness about him. And
is this Cooper or Kyle?
This is both. Both.
Where does one end and the other begin?
We don't know when the coffee runs out. But and the role of Dougie was that took a lot of courage because he was so deadpan. And I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. But the challenge, the most challenging was the role of the evil Cooper or the doppelganger, Mr. C. I said to David, I think at one point, I don't know if I can pull this off. Maybe I didn't say that because I didn't want to make him nervous. But I said, I have to, or we don't have a, we don't have a series.
What did you not think you could pull off?
Well, he's just, he's very, you know, he's a psychopath, you know what I mean? And he doesn't care. I'm fancy myself an empathic person, you know what I mean? It's like I like to engage, I care, I want to know what people are feeling and want to make sure that they're okay. So something like you said earlier, if it's not to please necessarily, but it's at least to be available to people. He's not. Mr. C is not. And I said, okay, I gotta go in and find that. And it was really challenging and satisfying in a way. And it was a character that I really enjoyed taking off at the end of the day. When I got out of the suit and stuff, I was like, okay, you know, I can come back. But it was definitely a change. And that low boil you talk about of keeping that energy when I was playing the Mr. C character, that was definitely there.
Are you happy with the work?
Yeah, I am.
Or is that generally true? Like, is that something that's hard for you to, like, is it hard for you to enjoy or think, or say, you know, actually, I am proud of this one?
It is hard for me to say that most of the time, even though I think it, it's like, you know, it's also that perfectionist thing where it's like, there's still room. Don't rest on this. Just keep, you know.
The eldest son streak stays alive.
That will haunt me for the rest of my life.
Your father was a tough, tough one to please, wasn't he? He was critical.
He was critical. I didn't think that he was that critical until years after he had passed. And I don't know why I never really...
Did you discover like a diary entry?
No, yes. I read his diary. No, I just remember moments that I would somehow... I mean, they affected me, you know what I mean? But I wouldn't let them really affect me.
You're big on that.
Yeah. I don't like to be manipulated or affected, you know, in a way, and which is, as an actor, not a good thing. You have to allow that to happen. And then, but he would also... I got to say, in his defense, that was pretty good. He would say, that was a pretty good job there. He was a pretty fair critic, tough critic.
You learned that years later. Why?
Yeah. Well, you know, I would think back, you know, on things that he would say. I remember my first vintage of my wine, you know, when I, in 2005, and he came to taste it, and you know, 3 months in the barrel or 6 months, even 6 months in the barrel is not tasting like wine. It's tasting kind of funky. And he said, you know, he would say to him, are you sure this is going to be any good? You know, it was like, I don't know. That's what the winemaker says it's supposed to be. But he was also very present. He was definitely like engaged as a father.
Right.
Which was very cool. And same thing with my son. If my son comes to me and says, hey, dad, I'm going to come out. Can you come out and video me skateboarding? And I could be in the middle of something and I'm like, I drop what I'm doing. I'm like, let's go. We went surfing the other day and he had his whole plan because he didn't have to be to school till 11:30. So we were up at 5:45 in the morning. Yeah, off we went. And he surfed a pretty intense, pretty gnarly spot off PCH. And I was there videoing him and doing it and really, really enjoying it. Loved it.
You have been enjoying a whole lot of videos I've seen recently of you on TikTok.
Yes.
I think your son is the sort of final arbiter, I think you called him of that.
Yeah, I have to check in with him now and then just to say, hey, listen, am I ruining your riz in school? And he said, no, it's okay, Dad, I'm fine.
That's how you phrased the question?
Yeah, because I speak like that now.
You do?
Yeah.
You've completely transformed, as an actor does.
Yes, you must change. We must roll with the punches and change with the times.
But do you think being a viral TikTok star is the role of a lifetime for you?
I am sort of enjoying this new notoriety. It will, I'm sure, disappear just as quickly as it came up.
As we all do.
It just seems to, I'm working with some very, very, obviously, some very clever people. But I'm enjoying the process too. It's definitely a collaborative experience and we're having fun.
And thinking about your career in a sort of more big picture way.
Yeah.
People have called up David Lynch many times for profiles of yours as a kind of reference. Mm. And they always say, why do you gravitate towards Kyle over and over and over again? And he has basically the same quote. There's some variations, but it's basically the same one. And he says, Kyle plays innocents who are interested in the mysteries of life. He's the person you trust enough to go into the strange world with.
Mm.
I just love that description.
Mm.
And I wonder, as, you know, soon to be 65.
Yes.
If you're still interested in exploring the mysteries of life through your work in the years to come. Is that something you still want to do? However challenging or complex or dark the world may be. Is that something that
I do.
Do you still want to be the gateway?
I do. And I think part of the fun of this, looking back over 40 plus years, is that that journey pursuing those mysteries changes because I'm now not 23. And so what I'm interested in and where I want to go and what I'm curious about, completely different.
Yes.
Than when I was that age.
The best analogy I can find to what you do as an actor comes from this cartoon.
Perfect.
That I think you really like. And I was wondering if you could take a look at it.
Yeah.
And explain it to the listeners and see if it means anything to you.
This is like a mysterious. Okay. You can see an old man with a cane taking a curtain call, and the crowd is going crazy. Next, you see him backstage pulling off the old man costume, and you see he's a strapping young guy. In the last frame, you see him at home pulling off the young man mask, and he's actually the old man with the cane. I think that's pretty brilliant. I love that. There is something that I about acting that I think is important to me, which is I don't have to agree with everything the character does. I don't have to, but I have to understand why they do what they do. I have to understand where it comes from. And I think if you understand that or make an attempt to understand that, you are all people, you know what I mean? We're all connected as people, but it's like you can make that journey between the old man and the young man and back again because you are all of those things somehow. That's important to me.
I mean, that's been pretty much your life's work.
Yeah. Crazy. And I still love doing it, Sam. Thank you so very much.
We took the strange scenic route.
I like this route because it's in both of our own words and it's not an article written that would modify it, right? So this is, you know, for better or worse, this is an expression of this moment, which I think is great.
So this will be Kyle MacLachlan in his own words, parentheses, and some of Sam's.
A lot of Sam, great questions, probing. I feel like I've been on the couch now for an hour.
And you know what? It's a consultation. It'll be free. Don't worry.
That's the best. The coffee was certainly worthwhile.
Damn fine?
Damn fine.
Kyle MacLachlan, a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your podcasting. If you want to go above and beyond, sharing the program with a friend, posting it on social media, you can tag us at TalkEasyPod. Really, all of this ensures that we can continue doing this work each and every Sunday. I want to give a special thanks this week to Kira Posey, the team at Podcast One, Spotify, and our guest, Kyle McLaughlin. Kyle's new true crime podcast, Varnum Town, is available wherever you are listening to this. If you'd like to learn more about the show or any of the films we talked about in today's episode, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more episodes, I'd recommend Laura Dern, Willem Dafoe, Lily Gladstone, and Steven Soderbergh. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs that come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. If you want to drop me a line, write us at sf@TalkEasyPod.com. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. It was taped at Spotify Studios in downtown Los Angeles. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Research assistance from Sharia Aranke. Graphics by Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Tara Machado, Justine Lang, Sarah Nix, Malcolm Gladwell, Greta Cohen, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with a new episode. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.